Oh, hello and welcome. Sorry, that sounded almost accidental.
you did download us. You should be expecting us. Come
yes.
on.
Surprised to find you here. Books of the Year, podcast, all that kind of stuff. Thank you very much indeed for downloading us. We were expecting you to do that.
Yeah.
Loyal and faithful listener. For example, here's an email from Jackie, who's in Germany. Dear Simon and Matt, I only recently discovered your podcast and have spent the last few weeks binge listening from the beginning.
From the beginning? Wow. When was it? 2018? Goodness me.
I have followed you through lockdown, through Matt's equestrian adventure.
Oh, boy.
And the changes in format over the years. Apart from introducing me to a plethora of fascinating books and authors, the podcast has also taught me about planners and pantsers in terms of how you write.
Yeah.
Now comes the contentious bit. I do not like books.
Right, okay. Interesting choice of podcast, you know. I mean, it's there right in the title. Fine.
Well, let's read on. When people rave about the smell and the feel of new books, it completely baffles me. I have many shelves of books at home, but I'm getting rid of them as radically as I can. They collect dust, they use up trees, they take up unnecessary space. I prefer to read e-books, which take up space,
okay,
where I can read in the dark without an extra light. I can adjust the font size to suit my eyesight and I never lose my place. This is not the case when it comes to an atlas, of course, or a beautiful coffee table book with exquisite photographs. Of course, these cannot be replaced by digital versions. So there, I've said it. I'm sure many listeners will be horrified, but I'm otherwise a dear little old lady who is just trying to prepare her home for when my surviving family have to come and sort it all out when I shuffle off the proverbial mortal coil. Keep up the good podcasting. Love the show. Jackie from Germany. Who's our first listener who doesn't like books.
Who doesn't like books. No, so actually, there are a few things in there that I do chime with. I mean, I prefer the sort of the paper books to e-readers. However, getting rid of books. Now, obviously, we've talked about this before. I would feel very uneasy about putting a book in the bin. I think it is a really good idea to go through your library and say, am I ever going to read that again? Or am I just... I mean, I am all for keeping books to show off so that when people come to your house, they go, ooh, look how well-read this person is. But I there's an awful lot of books I have in my house where I'm like, I'm never going to read that. I'm not sure I really enjoyed it. And the final criteria would be, do I like the cover? Literally that. And if I don't like the cover, then it's got to go. So I agree with Jackie on that.
It does sound as though Jackie is indulging in a bit of Swedish death cleaning,
yes,
as it's referred to.
We do enjoy a bit of that.
Where you do just get rid of stuff that that you don't want. So I think I'm not with Jackie in as much as I do prefer a physical book that I can write on.
Yeah.
I like to get my pen and underline bits.
Yes.
And stuff like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, Jack, I'm sure there are a lot of people. As long as you're reading, that's fine. I don't get along with e-readers, but Jackie does. Keep it all coming. You can get in touch with us, of course, booksoftheyear@yahoo.com.
Yes, an email from Ned. Dear fiction and non-fiction, a quick question for you both. I recently discovered Steve Kavanagh. Yes, thanks to your podcast. I read 13, which I've since discovered is the fourth in a series of his books featuring the main character, Eddie Flynn. My question is, should I go back and start from scratch or just carry on from where I've started? I never know what the done thing is when it comes to series, says Ned.
No such thing as a done thing.
No, there isn't. I mean, we are going to come to a book, not Jan Martel's book, but a book later on where I'd not read any of that author's books before. And it's a series of detective books. And I loved it and hadn't read any of his before. And I will definitely get into them. I don't think you need to go right to the start, though. I know when I was, obviously, I'm a massive fan of Rebus, and I read those higgledy-piggledy. I went in like six books in and then worked my way around. Whenever I found one of his books in a bookshop, I would just go, all right, I don't care where it is in the series, I'm just going to read that one.
After Anne Cleves came on the podcast a couple of months ago, I have gone back.
Yeah.
And read them pretty much in order, I think.
Yeah.
And I've also started watching the TV show as well.
Yes, yeah,
because there's hundreds of those.
Yeah, love those
on iPlayer, and that Douglas Henschel is so great as Jimmy Perez. So the first thing to say, Ned, is you can do whatever you fancy. You can either carry on in that order, and it may well be because Steve's very good that you can just drop in anywhere, and there'll be a little bit of updatey stuff as you go along. But maybe it pays to go back to the very beginning. It feels, going back to the beginning of the Bosch series by Michael Connelly, that feels really strange to have the character introduced to you. But the good thing is, Ned, they're all there. And I think I might be tempted to go back to the beginning. Matt just says carry on, so whatever you fancy, really. But if you've discovered a great new author, then all is cool.
Yeah, yeah, quite right.
Books of the Year at yahoo.com is where we are. And we're on Instagram, Threads and Blue Sky, at Pick Any Page. Okay, special guest time. He's a Booker Prize winner, you know. Jan Martell, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
How are you?
Very well, thank you.
It's good to have you back out on the trail, as it were. How long since the last book? I know the answer, by the way.
Well, they say 10 years, but it doesn't feel like 10 years. I have four kids. The youngest is 10. So 10 years ago, I had a 6-year-old, a 4-year-old, a 2-year-old, and a baby in the family. So much time was spent with them, as one should. So it doesn't feel like it's been 10 years, and I take my time writing. So it's been just the right length of time.
Exactly. Exactly, as any book should be, just however long it takes. So does that mean you've been working on this on and off for 10 years?
No, because I don't remember starting right after the birth of my youngest, so it must have been a year or two. My books always arise out of happenstance. I happen to read the Iliad. Usually I read big books between books. So in other words, I read big, charismatic, pulling you out of your orbit kinds of books between books. Because if I read them while I'm writing, they will pull me out of my orbit. So I remember consciously picking up the Iliad as a result of my partner Alice saying, you should read this translation. It's really, really good, by an American poet named Stephen Mitchell. So that must have been a year or two. And then I guess I've been working on it for that time, but I work slowly. I read slowly, I research slowly, I write slowly, I rewrite slowly. I traveled for the book. I went to Western Turkey, Western Anatolia, and I went to Greece. It was all slow and organic, and, you know, I didn't notice the passage of time.
Yeah. Okay, so we've mentioned already, so your book is Son of Nobody. You've mentioned that you've read the Iliad. So just give us the... Oh, actually, Matt, why don't you describe the cover, and well, then that can serve as an introduction.
So I suppose my first question is that is the copy, because obviously what we've got is a press copy, so is that going to be the cover that we're going to be seeing on our on our bookshelves? So it's a very... I love it. It's a sort of what would you call a blue and white mosaic, really, with in a sort of Greek style with, and this is where I start getting out of my comfort zone, either Greek stroke Trojan warriors patrolling the waves of mosaics. And then there's a silhouette of a man in modern dress who's walking and reading a book. Son of Nobody in black at the top, Jan Martell at the bottom, author of Life of Pi, winner of the Booker Prize.
Which was the last time I spoke to you, but that's like a quarter of a century ago, so we don't need to dwell on that. But anyway, Life of Pi did okay, didn't it?
It did okay, didn't it?
Yeah. So introduce us to Son of Nobody and how it came out of the Iliad.
It was a reaction to the Iliad. The Iliad was not the book I expected it to be. I was expecting something venerable, great, and slightly boring. It's not. It's like Game of Thrones. It's incredibly violent, but very thoughtful at the same time. You can see the origins of Greek philosophy in it. You have this, you know, Hollywood action movie kind of violence, incredible violence, you know, arms being chopped off, brains being shattered, skulls being shattered. And yet, in between those, there's people talking and musing on what's happening, why they're here, what do they get out of it. So it's a very thoughtful, violent epic. And so that I didn't expect. It's also the emotional tone surprised me. It's soaked in tragedy. It's a deeply, nihilistically tragic work where there's basically no redemption in life. Life is short, can be brutal, and there's nothing afterwards. At most, if you're really lucky, you're in the Elysian Fields, which are a very gray version of paradise. There's not much to do. You drift around unhappily, mourning your lost life.
Wow.
And maybe if you're really lucky, if you're the super elite, people are still talking about you in the world, like Achilles or Hector or Priam or Helen. So it's a very grim, grim work, all centered on anger. It struck me as interesting that the very first book of the West, the very first written work of the West's first book in the library, is all focused on anger and its consequences. It's not an exploration of the world. You'd think like Genesis, it would describe the Garden of Eden in a sense, or describe who's here. No, it's all focused on anger and its terrible, terrible consequences. And that's the first book that we presented to ourselves as Westerners. I thought that was how interesting that it's axed on this very negative, complicated emotion called violence. So Son of Nobody is a reaction, a digestion of that, of what do we do with that anger.
Okay. So therefore, if we're still in background, so introduce us then to Harlow Dunn and how you decided to tell his story and to write your own epic. So the two stories running together.
Well, it strikes me the only reason to look at the past, I mean, you could, I suppose, just for entertainment, but it's the lessons of the past have to apply to today. We look in the past to learn about today. So it was fascinating looking at the Iliad, the Trojan War. But I thought in terms of today, how does it apply today? Well, it does in many ways. So, for example, in the Iliad, the only people who speak, with one notable exception, are the upper class, the elites, the gods, kings, queens, princesses. Only one commoner speaks. And it strikes me we live today in a world like that, where the elites dominate us and aren't necessarily looking after us. They're looking after themselves. The Jeff Bezos and Elon Musks of the world, these people crazy with power and with greed. And they've captured the narrative. They dictate how we live today. And that's not right. It sucks for most of us. So I wanted to write a commentary on that. So in this novel, we have a scholar, a Canadian scholar, who has 1 year at Oxford on a fellowship. And he discovers among this wonderful trove of papyrus called the Oxyrhynchus papyrus that are housed in Oxford. They're from Egypt. He discovers this lost Trojan War epic. There's many, many stories told of the Trojan War. In fact, the Iliad is only 52 days of a 10-year war. He discovers another epic told from the point of view of a commoner, and he sets out to try to find the other fragments of this epic to try to reconstruct it. So the top of the page, the layout's quite unusual, the top of the page you have these verse fragments of this lost epic that he calls the Soad, and at the bottom of the page, after each fragment, you have these footnotes, which allowed me to tell both stuff on the Iliad and on the Soad, but also on Soas's own story. So they're unusual footnotes, they're narrative footnotes with dialogue and stuff like that. And they tell Harlow's story, which in many ways is meant to parallel the Trojan War. So in a sense, Soas is Agamemnon. I'm sorry, Harlow is Agamemnon. His wife Gail is Clytemnestra. You know, I try to establish these parallels to sort of establish how this story is far from irrelevant, but speaks to us today.
Okay. But to be clear, you wrote your own epic.
Yes, like in exactly the same way that Homer wrote his own epic. We are, as I say at one point we are talking myth here. We are talking myth. Myths, in a sense, have no authors, or on the contrary, everyone is their author. This is not history. There's no historical evidence for the Trojan War. Yes, there was a Troy, and there are traces of evidence of tension between Troy and this kingdom to the east called the Hittites, and with these Proto-Greeks, these early Greeks called the Mycenaeans. There's sort of slight evidence of tensions, this only in correspondences, but there's no actual evidence of any sort of an actual 10-year war. There's no history to it the way there is for the Punic Wars or the Second World War. There's none of that. All the characters are inventions from antiquity. So yes, I invented something, but I invented something that surely was already there. Surely there would have been commoners at the battles of Troy who, as they were dying, were thinking, why is no one going to sing of me? Why is no one going to mourn me? Why am I here? What have I done to deserve this fate? These are eternal questions that must have had answers that have been lost to time. So my feeling, like Homer, who something happened in Anatolia and the bard started singing, the people have been singing for centuries about what happened there, and I'm just the latest minor bard.
So the moment I knew I was going to love this book, Jan, was when I realised it was going to be a tale told by a commoner. Because I've never read the Iliad, but I know Achilles, I know Agamemnon, Helen of Troy, all of those kind of things. But I knew I was going to love this because it was going to be told by someone who, son of a nobody, eminently forgettable. And the reason why it chimed with me is, so I'm one of the judges for the Sports Book of the Year, and a couple of years ago we gave the award to tennis player called Conan Ireland, who, even if you're a tennis fan, you've no idea who Conan Ireland is. But he wrote about what it's like to be a jobbing tennis player, not to be a Federer or a Nadal, but just to be on that tour, and what you have to go through as just a jobbing tennis player. And I love that kind of insight, and I felt that I knew I was going to get the same here. You're not the main hero, you're not center stage, but you are experiencing this amazing tale. So I suppose the question I'm asking is, was that your starting point? Did you decide there's a story to be told here, but I'm not going to go to main character, I'm not going to go to the people that we're all familiar with, I'm going to go to the guy who's right there in the background, who you barely can see his face, I'm going to tell his story instead?
Absolutely, because that, after all, is the experience of most of us. One of the lines that I, you know, one like one's own book, but one of the lines I particularly like in my own book is where I say that we're all footnotes to a greater story. And to me, that's the case. We all live our little lives, trying to make the most of it. And it may feel at times minor, but in fact, we're all these footnotes. And it's these cumulative footnotes that explain the text above us that, in fact, are the text above us. Eventually, the collection of these footnotes make for the epics above us. You know, the collective footnotes of Britain make British history. And so there are no minor footnotes. And we are all footnotes. Even this morning, I was put up at this fancy hotel called the Mayfair on Stratton Street. And at breakfast, I happened to be facing the street. And I saw all these people walking by. And some you can tell were privileged because they had either very nice hair, very nice makeup, or really nice clothes. But their mortality showed through. I can see that, you know, little wrinkles that showed through, or little bellies that were a little bit distended. And, you know, their little mortality, they're trying to be more than perhaps they are. And you can't hide that. And I was touched by that, these attempts at, you know, they obviously had way more money than they had mortality, and they couldn't hide their mortality. And that's the way we all are. We are all these little footnotes walking around. And that's one thing I like in this book, is that I elevate the footnote to a starring role. Because to me, footnotes are important, because after all, that's what we are. We are these little footnotes.
And we're more interesting. We're more interesting than just a hero who is, you know, fabulous all the way through.
The heroes have their mortality too and are tragic. None of the heroes of the Iliad are uninteresting for being great, but they don't represent our lives necessarily. And I just find they're sometimes unaccounted for. And sometimes these minor lives, these smaller lives, say things that have great truth. So, you know, the lament of the person who's struggling, you know, there's only 24 hours in a day. We all work hard. And why is it that some of us work hard and we seem to get nowhere? In other words, work as hard as us and get everything. There's sort of a basic unfairness to that, which can lead to anger, and that can be righteous anger, but then what do you do with it? That's the question I think the Iliad asks is, you are angry, okay, that's established, what do you do now? Do you have it be sterile, violent anger, or do you try to somehow to do something with it? Those are questions that motivated me in writing this book.
What's one of the things that's so fascinating about this book is the experience, the physical experience that you have reading it. Mm. So just before you came in, we had an email from a listener in Germany who said that she doesn't like books. She likes e-readers, okay? So she's getting rid of books because she doesn't like them. She wants to read the digital version. Now, it seems to me that they might struggle with this because of, I mean, you've explained a little bit about what it looks like, but footnotes, almost by definition, are kind of throwaway, but not here. So when you open the book, every page is divided in half, and below the line, that's our academic story and his reactions and commentary on the text. And above the line, that's where the epic is. And I'd just be interested to know, just as a side thought, really, will e-readers and digital versions of this do this justice, do you think?
I don't know. But, you know, what I worry more about is the audiobook.
Audiobook.
Oh, my goodness.
The digital reader, I think they can manage it. Because after all, you can do graphic novels on e-readers now.
Okay.
So I think you'll just have to. And also, they look different. The verse fragments at the top of the page, because the dividing, by the way, for listeners, the division of the page is right in the middle.
Yes.
The footnotes are not at the bottom, you know, 20% of the page. They're fully halfway up. You know, it's quite clear when you read it. And I think e-readers, which after all can do graphic novels, will be able to quite clearly. And the verses look like verse. You know, they're in ragged line and they're tighter and they're column. in the middle of the page, whereas footnotes take the full page, are numbered, and have a little verse in italic that's the quotation. They look like footnotes. I think that'll be easy to figure out. It's more the audiobooks.
Yeah.
The audiobooks. I mean, yeah. As in Canada, and I'm sure it'll be the same thing here, the audiobook will have two readers.
Yes, must
one
be.
One who will read the verse and one who will read the footnotes. So that'll help you. But it'll be more the question of, like, each footnote starts with a quotation from the text. So it's, will the reader be able to weave it? I think they will, because after all, it is a narrative. I mean, the story at the bottom, yes, has little asides to do with Homer and Iliad and the Soad, but the story of Harlow is continuous, you know, is continuous. And same thing with the verse. You start with Soad's a story at the start when they arrive at Troy, yeah. And, you know, it is chronological. So we'll see.
So just to be clear, the Soad is the name that you've given to your epic.
Yeah, like the Iliad, yes, is exactly. About Ilios, the Soad is about Soad.
And you were talking about lines that stand out. You chose your favourite. I marked this one quite early on in the book. In Greek epic, no, this is from the footnotes. In Greek epic, no one listens and no one gets along. Then there's hell to pay. Well, that's where we are. No one is still listening. But my wife is a ceramicist, so our house is full of clay and pots and vessels, as she would rather have them, and ceramic structures and sculptures and so on. So I asked her about ostraca. Which is where we find the early words that had been written down. And it's from ostraca that we get the word ostracized. Could you just explain a little bit about ostraca and the significance of what we find written on them?
Yeah, Harlow.
I didn't know the word.
Yeah, ostraca is plural. Ostracon is singular. Yeah, Harlow arrives at Oxford and he, at a party, meets someone who's the curator of the classical collection at the Ashmolean, a wonderful museum at Oxford. And he goes there and she shows him around a bit. And one of the things he finds are these little bits of broken pottery. It is amazing what has survived from the past, how arbitrary it is. But, you know, think of us today. If I right now in front of here at the studio, I have a cup of herbal tea. Imagine if I dropped it on the floor and it was broken and it was swept aside and we'd forget about it. But you know, the fact is that 3,000 years later, someone might find it. And what might they deduce from it? Well, you know, it's industrially made. They could figure out where it was made, what it was made of. Possibly they might find fingerprints and be able to analyze that. But it's amazing. So in ancient Greece, people would have pottery for obvious purpose, you know, culinary purposes. And then when they would break, they would often then use them as writing material because they didn't have paper then. They didn't have papyrus. So they would have various other substrata on which to write, one of which was these broken bits of pottery. So they'd recycle them. And these then would be written upon. And once they were written upon and covered, they would be thrown out. And they'd be thrown out thinking they would vanish from time, but they haven't. And so we have these ostraca from the past with little bits of writing. And the Greeks were geniuses in terms of writing. They invented writing twice, or rather they took very rudimentary stuff and improved them vastly. So around 1000 BC, they invented Linear B, as it was called by Arthur Evans, the English archaeologist. It was a Cretan script called Linear A that they tooled and improved slightly to Linear B. Still fairly useless, clunky script, only used for accounting purposes and storerooms for commercial purposes. Not very, very, very limited, but nonetheless, it was writing. Then the Greek Dark Ages came upon them. Everything collapsed for various reasons, including possibly the Trojan War. And then around the 8th century, they reinvented writing. They took this clunky Phoenician script, added vowels to it, changed, it was, the Phoenician script was all consonants. They tinkered with it, changed some consonants into vowels, and that unleashed alpha, beta, alphabet. And that unleashed literacy. And so what are they going to write on? But these ostraca. So there's any number of ostraca with illustrations, writings. And this was a time when an entire population were learning how to write. So imagine people in grade school today, in grade one, you know, learning how to write. The letters are wobbly, it's poorly written, there's grammatical mistakes throughout. We have tons of those. And it's very charming to see an entire people for the first time learning how to write, as if the entirety of Greece was in grade one learning how to write. There's lots of those. And they have a certain charm to them in terms of the awkwardness of the writing. And they've survived through time. Yeah. So Harlow discovers some of these ostraca, on which were these references to Soas of Medea, this son of nobody of the novel.
Yeah, so this one says, I am here because of Soas of Medea, son of nobody. Who is our bard here? Who is writing that?
Well, that's one of the questions in the story, because after all, Soes is a commoner, and the scholar tries to figure out who he was, because it's very clear in the Iliad that Homer was a bard at the service of the elites, which makes sense. Bards would be hired by kings of palaces. They'd come in, and obviously you want to please the person who's paying you, so they would sing the praises of kings and their ilk. Whereas here, it's a very different tone, and so the scholar tries to figure out who it is. And ultimately, he figures out through internal analysis that the bard must be Thersites, this one commoner who speaks in the Iliad. There's only one commoner who speaks in the Iliad. And when he has a chance to speak, he rails against Agamemnon, saying, why are we here? You get all the girls, you get all the treasure, we get nothing. So why are we here? And in the Iliad, he's promptly beaten by Odysseus, because you don't want someone questioning the social order. And so looking at the text, Harlow deduces that the bard of the Soad must be Thersites, that after being beaten by Odysseus and being helped by Soas, that Thersites thanks him by doing what hadn't been done before to a commoner. He starts singing of Soas.
Yeah, that point where he's having a real pop at him, that's a great part of the book. I love that because, as you say, it's unbelievable that a commoner would, you know, have an absolute go at one of the generals. I want to expand on something you've already mentioned, Jan, which is the reading direct from the book where you say we have no historical proof for the existence of any of the protagonists or antagonists of the Trojan War, not for Helen, Paris, Agamemnon, Odysseus, Achilles, nor do we have any solid proof of any specific war between the ancient Greeks and the Trojans. And it struck me, I didn't know that. I thought the Iliad was based as close to it as on fact as, given I've not read the Iliad, I had no idea. But also, it's given you an enormous amount of freedom, because without revealing what happened towards the end, you have a completely different tale of what happened in the Trojan War. Even those of us who've not read it know about the Trojan horse. Does not appear in your version. So I talk a bit about this, the freedom that you had to imagine what you think will have happened in this war that we don't have any proof of.
Well, it's the freedom that I have, and indeed anyone, and that's exactly the richness of myth, that you can make it your own. And that's not just means that you can switch channels like from one streaming service to another. It goes deeper than that. And one thing that I allude to also in the book, a parallel myth, and I use that carefully, is the story of Jesus of Nazareth, which, you know, regardless of what we think of Christianity and all that, we'd all agree that Jesus Christ is a foundational character of human history, you know. And yet, exactly like with the Trojan War, there's very little history to Jesus. And we don't have a birth certificate. We don't have a death certificate. Most years of his life, we know nothing about it. We have this sort of symbolic birth in a manger. We have a story of him being forgotten at Jerusalem when he was 12. Then we have his ministry for roughly 2 or 3 years at the end of his life. In between, there's nothing. And even what we think we know about him, like his date of birth, which was pseudo-established 350 years later, had nothing to do with any factual evidence. It was much more, it was the winter equinox when the days start getting longer. So what better day to have a god be born, but when the days start getting longer, more light comes to us because a god is with us. It's purely symbolic. We have no history to it. And, you know, for the sake of comparison, let me give you the example, let's say, of Napoleon Bonaparte. Napoleon Bonaparte, we must literally have a million facts about him. Now, does that give him any more weight in people's minds? I would say no. And does it give him any flexibility to play with Napoleon? No. Precisely because we know a million facts, he's kind of stuck in cement. And we can only look at him in terms of factual truthfulness, and it's very hard to get something from that. What's wonderful about these stories with no facts, if they're great stories, if there's something that reflects who we are and who we want to be, is you can play with them and make them yourself, which is exactly what happens with people with Jesus, you know, whether you like him or not. I mean, you can look at the story of Jesus and, in a sense, make him your own. You can say, you know, what would Jesus say? What would Jesus do? What can I learn from him? We do that with Jesus and with the Trojan War in ways we don't often do with historical figures. I don't know how many English people once a day will say, what would General Wellington do?
Not many, I would say.
Not many, right? And it's nothing against history. We have to understand history and know who we are. But in terms of who we are as little footnotes trying to figure out our lives, it's these stories that mix fact and fiction that really can guide us. And I say that of Jesus as I might of Harry Potter with children. They read Harry Potter and it'll illuminate their lives and tell them how to behave and who they are. And it's a fiction. Of course it's a fiction, but sometimes fiction's our way to get to greater truths. We don't just get through truth through facts. Facts are important. You don't want to believe lies, but we have to go beyond that. We're not computers. So it's that mixture of fact and fiction that I've always been interested in. And it's perfectly exemplified with the Trojan War, where there are no facts to it, and yet it is the founding story of the Greek people, and therefore Western people, because we're founded on Greek thinking. Just as Jesus of Nazareth, there's no facts to him, and yet he's foundational Christianity, which is another strand of Western thing. So it struck me, and I mentioned this at the end of the book, how despite all our rationality, as I put it in the book, we walk on feet of dreams. One foot is Christianity, one foot is Greek stories. These are myths with no facts, and yet they're essential to who we are. So it's precisely their nature that they have to be adaptable. You have to be able to play with them, because otherwise we would let go of them, and you know, he'd be sort of not forgotten. Not that Napoleon Bonaparte is forgotten, but you know, he doesn't live with us every day the way the Trojan War can, and you know, for some people Jesus can.
Very early on, I was going to ask you this earlier, but I don't want to lose this kind of thread. When a young Harlow is told not to talk to his grandfather about the war, which of course he does, can you just explain the significance of that? Because I just think what the grandfather then says to his grandson is very profound.
Mm. Yeah, his father fights in the Vietnam War and then leaves the country right away, leaves the U.S. right away and immigrates to Canada, the way a lot of Americans did at that time. And he's obviously traumatized by war. We have visions of war as being glorious. That sort of ended with the First World War, but there was this idea for a child, certainly, that it's a glorious, you know, thing for heroes. And so his father was obviously his grandfather was deeply traumatized by it. And he finally does ask him, and his grandfather just finally says, you know, we're hiding place for monsters. We are hiding place for monsters, which is true. Behind, and Joseph Conrad pointed out the same thing, that behind this thin veneer of civility, there can be, you know, monstrous acts, monstrous thoughts. And it's precisely that what the Iliad is about too, is you have these people who are doing monstrous acts. I mean, the violence is horrific. It's really out of, you know, B Hollywood movie, the kind of violence. And you can sense the trauma. You can sense the trauma. And what do we do with this? What do we do with this? You want that veneer of civility, because otherwise we are monsters. So I think that's what sets Harlow as a young boy to wanting to study the Trojan War, because that's the blueprint of the hiding place for monsters, of people who, you know, have their proper place, but then err and stray from the straight path. Agamemnon starting right away with having this completely stupid argument with his key fighter, Achilles, and the disastrous consequences of that.
You've talked about hiding place for monsters. I want to talk about the bits where my heart leapt when I was reading this. And there was one point, I was on the tube reading this, and I had to get my pen out and underline the line straight away from your verse, where basically, so the scene set is Zoas is in an argument with a prince. And at one point, so the verse is, shouted Zoas, come dark-haired purple man, hero at words, dandy on the dance floor. And I loved it. I thought, oh my goodness me, how much fun was that? How much fun were you having with those words, Ian?
You should do the audiobook. That's exactly what.
Dandy on the dance floor. I am definitely using that phrase again. Oh my goodness me. So you talk to us about the times when you were having fun writing this.
Yeah, so the bottom are the footnotes. So those are discursive prose. We can believe those. It was really fun writing this epic, conceiving of this, you know, closing my eyes and pretending I was a bard and speaking from the point of a commoner. And what is a commoner going to do but, of course, attack the elites? And so in this story, in his warriory madness, Zoas decides to take on a prince of Troy, one of the 50 sons of Priam, Prince Mestor, who is mentioned in the Iliad in a sort of roundabout way as being godlike. So Zoas decides to take him on because Mestor has offended him by something that's real towards the end of what exactly he says to Zoas that so insults him. He insults his wife, and Zoas is outraged, and so nurtures his grudge, very Greek-like, nurtures his grudge against Zoas and decides to fight him, which would be complete insanity at the time. I mean, Zoas as a commoner, as a peasant, would have poorly fitting equipment, zero training in fighting. And here he takes on a prince of Troy who, that's all he would do. He would be training every day, have the best equipment, be constantly, so it'd be basically suicide. And so so he decides. And so, and he also does something that would be incredible. He commits deep lèse majesté by insulting this prince. And there's a, yeah, there's things where he's, and then, you know, so Mestre in return insults Soaz too. But here you have these, it was a very loquacious war. It's something too you see in the Iliad is there's no technology. It was very rudimentary. So your chances at mortality were pretty low. So what do you do? Well, you talk. And so and if you read the Iliad, it's really funny how there's these long dialogues of either people talking right near the front line or talking to the opponent right there. You, I hate your fucking guts. And they back and forth insulting each other. And I'm thinking, well, aren't you supposed to be fighting? And then occasionally they throw a spear or they avoid one. But it's, and so that's what's great about it too, is because they're speaking, they are saying things. And sometimes it's insults and jibes and taunts. And then sometimes, as I said, a little bit further back, they ask themselves really interesting questions. But it was particularly fun to write this because it allowed me to, you know, move my plot forward of what happens to Soaz, but also these little fun asides of, you know, what he might say to his opponents or to his friends. And yeah, it was a really fun experience doing that. It was very freeing. I the verses are in free verse, so I limit myself to 10 to 12 syllables per line. And I wanted a certain cadence, a certain rhythm going. And like anything, like when you write a song, the melodies at one point will move you forward. And so that was written much faster than, for example, the footnotes, which were more studied in their composition. The verses was sort of a, it's not quite that I pulled out a guitar and started singing, but it was kind of like it was, I was carried forth, which is why initially in the first drafts of this book, I had far more fragments and I had to, you know, cut them down to something, you know, to fewer of them.
How does studying the epic affect Harlow and his life? You've told us that he's studying it. He's come to the UK. He's at the Ashmolean. He's there for a year. He's left his wife and his daughter behind. What effect does that have on his home life?
Well, one of the things that I look at in the book is the worth of work. Is what we do worth it? The Greeks asked themselves that at Troy. Is it worth our while being here fighting this war endlessly, risking death every day? Is that worth it? Would it be better if we went back home and lived slightly longer lives of anonymity? Which is better? There's even a character who was told by a prophet that either you will die a painful death at home a bit later, or you can go to Troy and for sure die. And he chooses to go to Troy, die a quick death, but be in an epic, be in the Iliad, in a sense. So I ask the worth of work. So Harlow arrives at Troy. Harlow arrives at Oxford and makes this discovery. And he asks himself, is what I'm doing worth it? In fact, something tragic happens at home and he delays his return precisely to finish the job. And I think that wasn't just me inventing that. I think we are orderly creatures. I remember I had an aunt who died. And before she was dying, she was still concerned with, you know, to her husband, you know, don't forget to take out the garbage on Tuesday. And I must, you know, people, we want a sense of order in our lives, including when we come to death. I remember my father died 2 years ago, and half an hour before his death, he was a maid, a medical assistant dying. Half an hour before his planned death, he was on his phone texting people, you know, saying goodbyes. You know, you want that orderliness. So Harlow wants to finish this enterprise, which after all, he eventually realized he's doing for his daughter, because he misses them desperately. You know, I'm traveling here now. I have four kids. I miss my partner. I miss my children. My partner, I can keep the connection going with FaceTime and stuff like that. But with children, they couldn't be bothered talking to daddy. You know, he's not out of sight, out of mind. I miss them. And every day that I miss with them is lost. And so is it worth my while doing what I'm doing right now? I think that's a question we all ask, the worth of work. And so Harlow finds something great. It's kind of like he's Howard Carter discovering the tombs of Tutankhamun, and therefore he's late for supper. And yes, Tutankhamun is great, but is it worth being late for supper with your children? So it's that balance that one tries to get, that he tries to get.
Jan Martel's new book is called Son of Nobody. I'm hoping it's not going to be another 10 years before we talk to you again. Have you got another idea you're working on?
Well, since you mentioned that, yes, I was waiting for one of my editors to read it. And 6 weeks, I wrote an entire novel in 52 chapters that will be published in a box because you can read it in any order. You can shuffle the chapters, 52 like decks, like cards in a deck, like weeks in a year. It's about my mother's Alzheimer's, losing chronology. So I wanted to scramble the chronology of a story. So it's 52 chapters you can read in any order. It'll be called The Forgiven and the Forgotten. I'm working on that.
Right. So your audiobook editor is going to thank you again for that. How on earth is he or she going to deal with that? There'll be more with Jan in our Q&A episode, which will be along very shortly. But Jan, for now, thank you very much indeed.
My pleasure, Simon and Matt.